Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 38 of the Avocado Games Cast, the Avocado's gaming podcast. In this episode, we're going to revisit the topic of video game marketing. It's a topic we've talked about quite a bit on various podcasts, but we're going to approach it from a little bit of a different angle than we've covered before. This time, instead of looking at specific ads or slogans, we're going to talk about the hype cycle as a whole and hype culture and how we feel about it and the community that can build around it. We're also going to discuss what we've been playing lately. But before we get to that, let's introduce ourselves. My name's Merv, and joining me, he puts the play in PlayStation, it's Andy Tuttle.
Hello, I'm here.
He puts the don't in Nintendo, it's Wolfman Jew.
So cower in terror as Wolfmania strikes a horrified nation.
She puts the action in Frog Fractions, it's Flaxen Jackson.
Hi.
And finally, he puts the ass in Jurassic World Evolution, it's the Kappa.
What's up?
So, how are y'all doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
It's hot.
Yeah, it's super hot. I'm from Canada. I wasn't built for SoCal. But yeah, it's when it's hot outside, it is the perfect weather to stay indoors all day and play video games so that you don't melt. So what have you guys been playing lately?
I guess I'll go.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Tell us what you've been playing.
A couple weeks ago, or about a week ago, I finished Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door, which is one of my favorite games of all time, and Gorogoa, which is an excellent little indie title.
Is Gorogoa the one with the tiles that you have to position a certain way?
Yeah, it's a game that's essentially a puzzle that combines almost like a wordless comic book with kind of like a patchwork quilt.
Yeah, it looks really neat. Anyway, continue.
But true, and you know, I just started playing Splatoon 2, which is very fun. But really, the big thing that I've been playing recently is the excellent Hollow Knight.
So that's the one that's been sort of marketed as a 2D Dark Souls, right?
Yeah, so, and there's also, it's not the only one, of course, there's stuff like Salt and Sanctuary and a bunch of others who are kind of mediocre, but Hollow Knight is weird because it's, half of it's a 2D Dark Souls, half of it's a very, very well-designed Metroidvania, but then it's also given this incredibly, like, beautiful atmosphere that sort of, like, that actually combines those with, like, Studio Ghibli films, maybe a bit of H.R. Giger, into something that's this really odd, squishy, slimy, soft thing that's kind of sweet, and it's kind of scary, and it's this tonally singular thing, even if mechanically it's very similar to things that you've likely already played.
Yeah, mechanically, you know what it kind of reminded me of? I mean, I haven't played it, but based on what I've seen, it looked a bit like Apotheon, and that's kind of a Metroidvania that's kind of been forgotten, because it wasn't very good. But it's, I don't know if you remember that it was supposed to be this Metroidvania where the aesthetic looked like paintings on Greek, an ancient Greek pottery.
Yeah.
So it reminded me a bit of that, except for maybe this game is actually good and doesn't have garbage combat. So,
Yeah, there's a few main, like, kind of fun, like, things that could be considered actual innovations. Like, when you fill out a map, you have to actually save or die before you wake up at the bench, which is where you save, and that will fill the parts of the map that you've been to in. So it's not just going as far out as you can, it's trying to also find your way back. And a thing where you basically, every time you hit an enemy, you gain kind of a soul power, which you can then use to heal yourself or do attacks. So the more aggressively you play, the more able you are to heal yourself during combat. The main thing, though, is just that in every Metroidvania, ideally the things you get to, like the upgrades you get are for exploration. Like it's not just you get a new attack, but you get, you know, a new jump or a new like speed boost move or a dash. And here,
and then you access previously inaccessible areas.
Yeah. And, you know, because it's the idea of, like, the hard lock where you have to get a literal key and a soft lock, which is, you know, the thing where you try to bypass. And, you know, every so often in this genre, you'll find some items that kind of are just crappy and really only used just to open locks. Hollow Knight doesn't have that. There's only a few upgrades you actually get over the course of the game, but every single one is so empowering and so interesting that it suddenly, like, makes your mind race with, like, potentially dozens of ways where you can employ it.
Yeah, so it evinces, like, really thoughtful game design, where you think about not only, okay, what doors can this open, but how can I actually use this, you know, in combat or platforming or what have you. So that's Hollow Knight. Andy, what have you been playing?
I've been playing a lot of Fire Emblem Warriors on the Switch.
That's the Musou title.
It came out, I think, last November, something like that. I was like on the fence about getting it when it came out, because I'm not a big, like, Fire Emblem fan. I mean, I like the series, like the games that I've played. I played the one on the Wii and the one on the Game Boy Advance, but I didn't really, like, know anything about any of the characters, so I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be into this, because I really loved Hyrule Warriors, but I know everything about Zelda, and I didn't know anything about Fire Emblem. Anyway, I love the game. I think it's great. All the Musou games that I played have been really good, except for Dynasty Warriors 9, which I really hated that game.
I've heard the stories about that game.
Yeah, it's not good. We can talk about it later, but Fire Emblem Warriors is it scratches that Musou itch, you know, where it's just that single contained map. You're running around from fortress to fortress, you know, knocking out the commander, capturing it, moving on to the next objective, saving so and so, collecting whatever weird item you need to collect to, like, you know, unlock your special moves later on. It's great. It's a lot of fun. And I think it works for me because I don't know any of the characters, so I'm not sitting there wondering, what am I going to play as Marth, or what am I going to play as so-and-so? So I've really gotten into the main, I guess the two new main characters they have. I can't remember their names. The blonde-haired twins.
They're great. A prince and a princess, are kind of the default main characters in the way that, like, Marth or Crom were default main characters. Sorry, Andy.
I for whatever reason, their names are it's not on the tip of my tongue right now, but anyways, I've connected a lot with them, aside from knowing their names, but I've connected with them in a way that I think if I had played the other Fire Emblem games, maybe I wouldn't have, because I'd be wondering, like I said, when am I going to play as these other main characters that I know and love? Instead, I've fallen in love with these two new characters. So I love it. I love it a lot. Big thumbs up. If you haven't played it yet, go out and play it. Great game.
Awesome. Flax, what have you been playing?
I am just getting around to Mass Effect Andromeda. I had a driver issue on my PC, and it made me want to tear my hair out every time I tried to address it, because it's like, fix the driver before the system crashes. So I kind of wasn't gaming for a while. Otherwise, I would have gotten to this a lot sooner. So I finally got it fixed, and I finally got it up and running. And I'm enjoying it a lot. I know I've made a couple posts, I think, on the open threads about obviously the delay in me playing allowed a lot of bugs to be fixed for me.
Yeah.
As opposed to playing it right when it was released. And that's kind of my MO. I rarely start playing things right when they're released. So I'm really enjoying it. Not really understanding a lot of the hate that's been heaped on it. But there are obviously things that I think could have been improved. But overall, like, I'm pretty satisfied, and I'm bummed that there's not a DLC coming out for it.
Yeah, because they've generally, the Mass Effect DLCs have been pretty hefty.
Yeah, and very additive.
Yeah.
Like, Omega and Citadel and Lair of the Shadow Broker all, like, did different things that the main games didn't do.
Forgetting which Lair of the Shadow Broker is one that sort of starts out as a detective story and then kind of, like, branches out, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so they all do slightly different things. Like, even though they're mechanically very similar to the base game, they tend to be slightly different in tone or tell kind of a related but separate story.
Yeah.
So what are you enjoying about Andromeda?
Just general, like, I enjoy, like, the, well, kind of the open world expansive feel.
Is it similar to Dragon Age Inquisition in that
feel? Yeah, it's a little overwhelming in the amount of missions that they will pile on you, and in that respect it might be a little much, but at the same time it just means, you know, there's a lot of game to play, so I like that. Just playing these types of games I find very relaxing for some reason. Yeah. I'm kind of drawn to these games.
Yeah, when you got this really big, meaty game sometimes and you're not super worried about driving through the end, it can be relaxing. You just hop in there for an hour and clear out some outposts or what have you.
Yeah, like shoot some stuff and, you know, it's just very, you know, let go of things.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Andromeda too. I think a lot of it was people were comparing that game to a whole trilogy, and it wasn't coming out well, you know. But as a starting point for something new, I feel like Andromeda had a lot of potential, and it sucks that they gave up on it so easily.
Yeah, I've tried to read up on what the future for Mass Effect is, and it's pretty vague so far. It doesn't sound like they're going to continue with the characters established in Andromeda, which is a shame. So I don't know where that leaves the franchise.
I think it's, for the foreseeable future, dead, and which is sucks. And I really didn't like Andromeda, but it's really sad that it didn't get I didn't hate it, and I kind of wish that it got more of a chance to kind of expand and to explore what it wanted to be. So that it kind of ended like that is... And by ended, I don't mean with the plot so much as with the franchise, like, as in general. It does make me sad. And
yeah, especially now that BioWare is going to have their hands full with Anthem. They're going to be the Anthem and Dragon Age studio for the foreseeable future, really. I don't see them do anything else.
Yeah, that's too bad. I love Mass Effect.
Yeah, it seems like a bad choice on their part to discard the whole franchise based on this.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes things that get shelved get revived later, yeah. But they haven't officially made an announcement like, oh, we're shelving Mass Effect, but that's just what the scuttlebutt is, and sometimes it's accurate.
If I had a guess, I think they probably feel like they told the story of Shepard, and they don't want to go back to that. And then they tried something new, and people said, we don't want that. So now they're kind of like, they're in a corner. What is Mass Effect as a story, you know, without Shepard and the Reapers and all the other stuff that people seem to want? Because it doesn't really make sense to go back to Shepard. But, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they're kind of reluctant to go back to that time in the galaxy and tell side stories, because they'll feel almost too small scale next to the big Reaper threat. They try to do something new.
It's also, I think, kind of an issue with the fact that that game ends in one of three radically different ways, and it's functionally wouldn't really be possible to make a game that could adequately reflect all of those endings.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you'd basically be kind of like making prequels, because they would never want to go like make an actual sequel to that.
Yeah, and the lore kind of limits their prequel possibilities, because at the time the games take place, humans haven't been part of the galaxy for very long, or part of the wider galactic community. So you could go back, what is it, like 30, 40 years max from when the Mass Effect stories are set. There's not much you can really do there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right, Kappa, what have you been playing?
Oh, so much. I guess I can... Do we talk about Jurassic Park already?
I think you talked about it. You can talk about it again.
I'm not going to talk about
that.
You
can talk about whatever you want.
No, I'm not going to. I'll talk about XCOM. I came back to XCOM after a long time away. XCOM 2 has an absolute ton of stuff now in the workshop. Like, so much stuff, you won't believe it. And there's a lot in there that you can just kind of jump in and download right away. I'm liking it. It seems like they fix a lot of the little things as far as the old squad site stuff now. Have you guys played XCOM 2 or XCOM 1?
I've only played part of Enemy Unknown.
Well, so this is such an easy little tweak that I can't believe they haven't done it before. So XCOM 2, when you start a mission, you start concealed. So your guys can't be seen. Because one of the most annoying things about XCOM 1, at least, would be you move into the enemy's range, he sees you, he runs up to you, and he shoots you before you can even act. Does that make sense?
So, oh, yeah, I remember. So it makes people play kind of overly cautiously.
Exactly.
Kind of one square at a time. It just takes time for matches to start going.
Yeah, so one of the most subtle things they fixed, they don't do that anymore. Now you start out concealed. As long as you don't run into the eyesight range, which is kind of represented on the grid, then you're all right. You can keep, like, kind of bounding forward rather than just moving very, very slowly. They did some cool stuff with the Sparks, is what they call them, which are the mechs. They look really neat, and they do a lot more utility stuff rather than just being unstoppable tanks. The only problem I'm having right now is squad development right now feels very random. You know, it used to just be who ends up being PsyOps, but now it's kind of a combination of who unlocks which class, which unlocks further classes, which unlocks side stuff. So
they made, like, gigantic skill trees almost?
Yeah, exactly.
Development trees?
Yes, you can end up with a character that is good, but he's one of your higher level ones, but he's got kind of like a not the best skill background. So yeah, that's kind of one of those things that's annoying, but XCOM's still a lot of fun. It, like, the core gameplay and what the game itself does is a lot of fun. So yeah, I'm having a good time with it, actually. I wasn't expecting to, but it's a good little time waster.
Yeah, XCOM is a game that I kind of wanted to like a lot more than I did. My XCOM experience and why I didn't complete the game is it was just too bug-ridden for me to keep playing. But I think I ended up sort of on the upper tail of the distribution of bugs.
Yeah.
Because most people had a relatively bug-free experience.
Most of that's probably pretty much fixed now. But yeah, when it first came out, I remember losing whole saves. So that's one of the reasons that I quit it, and I'm just coming back around to it now too. And so far, so good.
Yeah. What I ran into was, I had two problems. One where it would just randomly reorder my saves and I wouldn't be able to find my actual save. And the other really annoying bug is that sometimes it would just randomly skip my turn or ignore my action.
And that Yeah. That'd be really annoying.
So I was like, you know what? You fix this and then I'll come back. And then it's been a few years now. But it's good to see that they've taken kind of fan feedback to heart and amended a few things that were a little bit annoying the first time around. So it's good for the franchise, I say. All right. So what have I been playing? I've been playing Mario Tennis Aces a lot lately. And it's been a long time since I've kind of played a game where I thought, okay, I need to play this, like, every night before going to bed. Yeah, because what I do now is, like, I play my Switch. I go to bed, and then I play my Switch for an hour and then turn off the lights. And that's been how I have treated Mario Tennis Aces. So,
all I know of Mario Tennis Aces is, did you see the video where the guy just picked Baby Bowser at a competition and beat everybody?
I've heard Bowser Jr. is super OP, but I've tried using him, and he's super, super hard to use. So he's OP if you know what you're doing, but if you don't know what you're doing, then he's a really bad character.
It's the clown car.
Yeah, it's very hard to control. He doesn't control as well as some of the other characters, and then it's very hard to see because you don't have a sense of where his feet are. It's very hard to to sort of judge where he should be on the court. So the tennis game, I've kind of ripped. It works pretty well. It's very arcadey, so don't expect a realistic tennis simulation. And occasionally, especially the higher level computer AI is extraordinarily difficult. But it's really nice and intuitive to play. Very simple, but there's a lot of depth. And it does replicate some aspects of actual tennis playing. Like, you can play more aggressively or less aggressively. So, you know, if you're good at reacting quickly, then playing at the net is a viable strategy. So you can be a serve and volleyer if it makes you happy. Or you can just baseline rally if that makes you happy. You can switch it up. You know, it works pretty well. The other thing is that it has an adventure mode, which is like a single player story mode, which is bizarre. And it, like, the plot is as thin as plots get. There's an evil racket that has turned Luigi and no, just Luigi evil. I guess it made Waluigi and Wario even more evil, but you know, that's how these things go. And then you have to go find 5 power stones to unlock the power that'll defeat the evil racket or something like that. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Point is, it's basically an excuse for you to hit things at other things. So there are two kinds of things that you do in this game. Either you hit stuff at other stuff, or you play rounds of tennis. And usually play rounds of tennis, it's because you meet someone who's like, oh, I'll do something for you. Just you have to beat me at tennis first. So they try to come up with sort of the thinnest premise that you'd be playing somebody else in a tennis match. And apparently tennis is the solution to everything in this world. But I don't know. I kind of enjoy it when there's just like a world based around some ridiculous mechanic.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Mortal Kombat stories now. You know, the Mortal Kombat story mode where it's like, I'll help you on your quest, but first we've got to fight. Just for no reason. It's very...
Yeah, it's... Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, can you just imagine living in the Mushroom Kingdom every time one of these sports titles comes out? It's like that's the one thing everybody is fixated on, you know, in the Mushroom Kingdom for like a month. Like, okay, everybody needs to learn how to play tennis. Make sure you get your shit together. Like, it's tennis time. Like, you know, oh, now it's basketball time. Oh, now it's soccer time. This is all we're fixated on, the whole kingdom, for, you know, a month. Everyone learn how to play basketball. And then they do. That's so funny.
See, Mario Tennis Aces gets around that by setting itself on an island that isn't the Mushroom Kingdom.
Okay, well, there you go.
But it's still ridiculous because everybody's there. Like, they all took a vacation together. It's not just like Peach and Mario going for a getaway. Luigi and Daisy and Toadette and Rosalina are all in tow, too. So they just, like, take group vacations.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and there's ghosts there too. Speaking of which, I have the game. I'm playing it. I'm in the ghost area, and I gave up. I couldn't do it. It's the one where you have to hit the ball against the mirror in like the perfect circle spot.
Okay, for that particular challenge. I don't know if you want me to spoil it how you do that challenge.
Oh, go ahead.
But you have to use the different kinds of shots to hit each of those. Like, the ones that are in the middle, you have to use topspin shots, and the ones that are down below, you have to use flat balls or slices.
Huh.
And the high ones obviously use lobs.
Okay. See, yeah, I just used the hit. Whatever the... I just... A. That's all. I used A for everything.
Yeah, so then you're just only going to hit the middle row. So you have to switch it up and use your different kinds of strokes to hit the other ones. Yeah. But it's still hard, even if you figure out how to do that. Sorry, Wolfman, go ahead.
I was just going to comment on or make a note on Andy's comment about how everyone gets super, super obsessed about everything in the Mushroom Kingdom. Yeah. And how, like, I love Mario Kart 8, which is why I play Mario Kart 8 a lot. And there's, like, one of the most iconic tracks in that game is its version of Mario Circuit, which is basically this massive upside-down, like, loop, like, figure eight loop-de-loop around Peach's castle that uses like anti-gravitational technology, and they just built that like around her castle.
Yeah, they got some engineers, man. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, she has like a kingdom full of toad servants to do her bidding, so I figure she could just do whatever she wants. It is kind of hilarious, but Mushroom Kingdom operates on, like, not even, I don't even know if you'd call it video game logic. It operates on its own weird internal logic. And if you think too hard about it, it all just sort of falls apart.
Yeah, it's like Bowser's, you know, this evil terrorist who's constantly kidnapping their princess. But you know what? We're going to go play soccer now.
Also,
how does that make sense?
I've been looking on the Super Mario Wiki while we've been talking, and yes, you, Merv, you are not lying at all. The villain is an evil golden tennis racket named Lucien.
Yep, that's it. Yeah, and apparently, yeah, he enslaves Luigi, and then the climax of the game is like you have to fight your own brother. I don't care that I'm spoiling the plot because the plot doesn't really matter in this game. So you spend the whole game building up to that moment. The other thing is that it's preceded by a match where you out of nowhere just play as Peach for one match, and like this doubles thing. And up until then, the game has never introduced the concept or the rules of doubles to you. It's just like, oh yeah, play doubles, so now you're Peach. And you don't have any of your experience or your skills. And you can't hit trick shots. Enjoy! So that was a weird challenge out of nowhere. It's clearly not made by one of Nintendo's internal studios. Like, it's made by Camelot Soft. So it has all the Nintendo aesthetic and the Nintendo humor and all that, but it doesn't have that sort of extra level of Nintendo polish. And not polished in the sense that it's a buggy game. It's not a buggy game at all. Polished in the sense that it's not as intuitive as just picking up an in-house Nintendo title.
So. Although, it does mean that they do what Nintendo probably wouldn't do, which is have a playable Chain Chomp play tennis.
Oh yeah, that's one of the most hilarious things in the entire game. That you could just also a Chain Chomp doesn't even have hands, right? So the way it serves the ball is that it like bounces the ball off its head, I guess you'd say, and then like its racket magically floats and hits it. And then also there's Spike, and I don't know what game he's from.
He's from Super Mario Bros. 3 or Super Mario World. He would throw Spike balls.
Yeah, so he's from way back. So he has hands, but for some weird reason, he grabs the ball with his mouth and spits it into the air to serve.
That's because that's what he did in Super Mario. He would hold like a giant spiky ball in his mouth and then throw it up and then throw it at you.
Okay. Good to know that there.
Yeah.
See, yeah. Things that looked logical in 16-bit don't look logical in fully animated 3D. So, like, I understand it's a whole legacy thing and they're trying to honor Mario's past, but it just ends up looking hilarious. I've been having a good time with it. It's been sort of highly addictive. It's the game that I play every night before going to sleep, so highly recommended as an arcade sports title.
Right on.
All right, so I guess we'll move on now to the main topic of discussion. So we wanted to talk about, you know, how video games are marketed and sort of the hype cycle that builds around them. So let's start by asking ourselves, what games are we hyped for right now? What upcoming games are you super interested in, and why are you hyped for them?
I guess I'll start. Cyberpunk definitely is my number one. I mean, I think we talked a little bit about that during the E3 one. And I would say between that, Fallout 76, and the Destiny expansion, those are probably my top three of what I'm excited for, and all kind of for different reasons. Cyberpunk, because it's kind of something new. It doesn't look like The Witcher at all, which is one of the things I was worried about. Everything they showed looked cool and fresh and new. Fallout 76 is something that I kind of know about, but it's doing something very new and something that I already know about. And Destiny expansion is kind of like, it's exactly, I know exactly what it is. So kind of, that's kind of like the spectrum of how I get hype for stuff, you know, something new, something familiar, but doing something new in it, and more, something that's going to improve, you know, what I have been playing. So between those three, that's kind of like right now my current three things I'm hyped for.
Yeah, so regarding Cyberpunk 2077, I think I mentioned this all on the last episode, but what kind of sold me on it wasn't the trailer. It was what people said about the closed-door preview. So there were a lot of articles that went up on various gaming websites describing what that demo looked like. And the kind of gameplay they described in it really appeals to me. The whole, you know, like first person running combat parkour, chatting with people, all that stuff.
That's kind of where I was at too, and I wouldn't say pessimistic. I was kind of on the fence on it because I didn't love The Witcher as much as everybody else did. I thought it was okay. I thought it was a good RPG, but Geralt sucked. The world was kind of dead, you know, stuff like that. And then I feel like that what I saw of the at least even just the, I don't know what you want to call it, the trailer showed me at least enough, hey, we're going to have a populated game world. There's going to be a lot going on. It's not going to be as straightforward as, you know, creepy Witcher guy was. So that kind of gave me a little bit more confidence, and everything I read about behind the scenes did even more.
Yeah, I think what I'm sort of excited for is that they seem to recognize that, you know, maybe building the most expansive world on the planet isn't necessarily what we want to do here. There was emphasis on depth and density and verticality, which I think are important, especially for, you know, this shining cyberpunk city. You want it to be dense with stuff to look at, because the whole idea of cyberpunk is that's kind of bombarding you with information from all angles. And I kind of want to experience that in the game. Also, like, the Deus Ex franchise is kind of on ice right now, so I'm looking to scratch that itch. So, what else are you guys excited for?
I'll go. So everybody knows who listens that I'm a big Yakuza fan, right? So obviously Yakuza Kiwami 2 is coming out in August, which I'm definitely going to get. But the one that I really want to play is this Fist of the North Star version that they're making.
Oh, yeah.
It's coming out, I think, in September or October. I don't know. But it looks – it's Yakuza, but it's, you know, in the Fist of the North Star universe. So it's this weird, like, post-apocalyptic –
yeah,
wasteland.
Basically Mad Max Yakuza.
Exactly. And so watching the trailers, they even got the same guy to do the voice of Ken. So Kiryu and Ken have the same voice actor. So it's almost like you're playing, you know, his cosplay of Fist of the North Star. It's great. The combat looks intense. It's got all the rapid fist punches and the pushing people's heads with his fingers and they explode. I don't know. I'm very excited for it. And you get to be a bartender. So that's really what I'm hyped for right now.
Yeah, I've been looking at it. I don't know if I'm ready to dive in with both feet, but it does seem at least intriguing. So
I think we'll have to be a fan of the anime probably to really kind of be into it. I used to watch it a lot when I was a kid. So
yeah.
good kid show.
A little before my time, unfortunately, but yeah, I can see if you have an attachment to the property that, you know, you'd be super excited. It's kind of like me in Digimon games. I know they're not like objectively great games, but if you give me like a Digimon, like another Digimon story game, it's basically Persona but with Digimon, I'm on board. I'm gonna buy that. Yeah, Wolfman, what are you hyped for?
Probably unsurprisingly, for people who, you know, regularly hang out at the Avocado or know me, it's Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. But since Super Smash Bros., I have a lot of, like, a very positive relationship with its hype cycles. I feel like it'll be better for me to talk about it when we talk about that. Instead, I'll just say that I am cautiously optimistic for My Friend Pedro, a game about a sort of an action shooter game about someone fighting crime under the orders of a talking banana that, while almost painfully quirky in premise, also involves a very balletic kind of action gameplay, which makes it, I guess, a side-scroller version of Hotline Miami.
Yeah, it looked really neat when I saw it. Like, it was revealed, I believe, at the Devolver Digital, I guess you could call it a press event, at E3. So, yeah, it did look... It's not the kind of game that I think I'd enjoy playing, because it's not something I'd be good at, but I'm really intrigued. Just by the tone, I think they've kind of nailed it.
Yeah. I'm also, just as a short thing, I'm also interested in something called NeoCab, which is sort of like the diametric opposite of Cyberpunk, in that it's this very indie game where you play as a taxi driver, and the story goes by you kind of interacting with your character's cell phone.
Yeah, it's, you know what it reminds me of? This free game from a few years ago called Glitch Hikers, where you picked up, it had the same sort of purplish, quasi-futuristic aesthetic, and instead of being a taxi driver, you're just a regular driver, you picked up hitchhikers and had conversations with them. It was an interesting experience.
Sounds interesting. I have to check that out. What's it called?
Glitch Hikers. Sorry. Glitch Hikers. Yeah, NeoCab is what Wolfman was talking about, which also looks really neat. So check that out, too. Flaxen, what are you excited for?
probably I'm... Well, not anything that's coming out anytime soon. Probably the next Dragon Age game and the next Elder Scrolls game.
Yeah, at least we know that they're both in development.
Yeah, I find that odd that the way that all is announced, like, I guess as part of the hype cycle, is like, we're going to hype that we're actually working on this. And I don't totally understand.
We know
we're
working on it.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of happy with what BioWare is doing with Dragon Age 4. They didn't come up with some big trailer or make a huge E3 announcement about it. They're just like, yeah, you and I both know we're working on this. So, you know, we're going to keep quiet about it for now. But yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah. The Elder Scrolls trailer I saw from E3 was just kind of like
almost.
Yeah, I don't know if one came out after this, but it was just like, look at this landscape, and okay, we're working on the Elder Scrolls.
They had to come out and make this official announcement that they're working on it, because they're playing coy all along.
Like, yeah, like, you're not going to follow up Skyrim, right?
Yeah,
it's like, no, just give me a date.
They're going to keep making Elder Scrolls games until, you know, the death of the universe. So I don't think this is a surprise.
Yeah, I think Todd Howard actually literally came out with an interview a few days ago saying, like, the only reason we keep re-releasing Skyrim is because people keep buying Skyrim, and if you want us to stop doing that, don't keep buying it.
Well, yeah, I mean... he's not wrong, right? Yeah. People have bought Skyrim on everything. I forget, was it at the Bethesda conference that they had that skit with Keegan-Michael Key?
Yeah, the Alexa.
So here's the thing. I think a few days before E3, I made a joke that they'd announced Skyrim for a Samsung smart fridge. And then that appeared in that stupid skit.
Seriously?
I don't know if you knew that, but that Alexa skill is actually real. There's actually an Alexa for Skyrim thing.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
You can play Skyrim on Alexa.
So, like, can you legitimately say things like,
yeah, like,
Alexa,
I use my dragon voice, yeah, carry my burdens, all that stuff.
What the hell?
Sorry.
I mean, is this for people who do not have use of their hands?
No, it's completely a joke. It's
based
off of their E3 thing.
Oh. I was going to say, I thought I saw some controllers that have come out for people with disabilities with their arms and hands, but
yeah,
this seemed new.
It's more like a text-based adventure that you talk to.
Okay. Yeah, they do have like those controllers for disabled gamers. Some of them are foot-based too.
Oh.
I've actually used one for a completely different application in scientific research. So it's when you need to monitor stuff that's going on in people's hands, but you also need them to respond to questions, and then you make them respond with their feet. So there's no like pre-existing device to do this, so you buy like a foot pedal for disabled gamers and you use that. Anyway, so we're all hyped for these titles for different reasons. We mentioned some of them, like previous familiarity with the franchise is probably the biggest. Sometimes it's, as Cap mentioned, it's that they're doing something new. For me personally, I'm hyped for this indie game that's coming out next year called Sable. Woo-hoo. And that's based almost entirely off the strength of the trailer. Because it's like, it has this very striking art style that shows off really well. It's trying to recreate the works of the French artist Mobius, also known as Jean Giraud. Jean Giraud, also known as Mobius. You know what I mean. And also the music in the trailer is really nice. And I found out afterwards why I liked it so much, because it was done by one of my favorite artists, Japanese Breakfast. So basically Mobius plus Japanese Breakfast, who I found out later is doing the entire soundtrack. It's basically like somebody is spying on me and decided to make a game for me. So I'm a little bit disconcerted, but I'm also super hyped.
I got a question.
Sure.
How has it taken this long to get a video game with art based on Mobius?
So other games with that kind of art style do sort of exist. Like, I'd say Cloud Built sort of inspired by Mobius. Mm-hmm. But that, I think this is the first one to sort of capture not just the mechanical parts of it, or like the angular parts of it, and also add in the kind of desolate desert landscapes and all that as well. Yep. So, yeah, I think it's definitely an aesthetic that's rife for video game exploitation, as it were. But yeah, some games I think already have been sort of inspired by it, even if they haven't tried to ape it exactly.
I think Out of This World kind of has that look too.
Yeah, there was also this very, very, there's also a few like indie games that came out in the past couple of years that had something similar too.
Yeah, so I think this is the first time that developers have come out and said, yeah, this is explicitly sort of Mobius by way of Ghibli. Although there's only really one Ghibli film that uses the Mobius aesthetic, and that's Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, and that's not even technically a Ghibli film. So I don't know why they mentioned Ghibli, but you know, let's let them say what they say. So yeah, we're all hyped for these games for different reasons. What sort of works to get you hyped for a game besides just familiarity with the franchise? Let's say you're going into a franchise cold. What sort of gets you excited?
You know what works for me, and it's kind of weird, it depends on the game, of course, but I really love like lore dump style Vidocs, where you get like one of those kind of like one of the head writers or something. He's like, look, this isn't just so much about this game, this is about this game world. And like they talk to you about, you know, here's the different factions, here's what's been going on. Like, it's almost more like they're telling you a story about the game world rather than just, yeah, this game's going to have so many features and this and that. It's like, because that way I get to, like, kind of get a head start in my head of building up, that sounds cool. I can't wait to see how this happens with that character. I wonder what this faction's like when I actually meet him. Those are the kind of things I think that let me build a little bit of my own head story that gets me more excited about a game than them just telling me it has, you know, the biggest map since whatever, you know, like, or the super high res graphics. Or I'd rather hear more about the game world than the lore and the systems that are in there. But a lot of times they don't like to trot those writers out for some reason, you know. So, but when they do,
yeah, you know why I think that is? Because for a lot of games, writing happens late in the development process. Yeah. Like, they essentially have the game, and then they graft a story onto it. So they might not have finalized all the details at the time they start hyping the game up, which
I think it's
a little bit like putting the cart before the horse. But
maybe that's why it works so well then. You know, maybe it's like, okay, we kind of put the story first, so it's going to work a little better. But that's what I look for, is if they can talk to me about the game world early on in the development, I get a little more excited than I would them just talking about gameplay system or map sizes or anything like that.
Yeah, and that it's a good sign that they know what they're doing as far as integrating the story with the rest of the experience. So, like, if they're giving you lore dumps, that's a good sign for development, I think. But, you know, I'm not a game developer, so take that with a grain of salt.
One thing for me is, I guess that kind of does, that is tied into that, is basically for a game that tries to get away from the pack. Like, something that, like, I think at the Microsoft conference, one of the few, like, really kind of uplifting game trailers, because everything was very dark, was this small game called Tunic, which is kind of a puzzly Zelda clone-y thing.
Yeah.
And that's really not, and, like, normally it looked nice, but I think it comes across especially nice when it's put in a conference with, you know, a very kind of ominous Halo trailer, a very kind of dark and ominous Gears of War trailer.
Yeah, it definitely stood out as something unique in that conference, and which is saying something, because they showed off a lot of games at that conference.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it contrast does help for sure.
So, yeah, like, I love things that are surprising or crazy, like Sable's art, but, you know, just trying to kind of be really distinct in an industry where, like, a lot of the biggest games on the market are often kind of indistinctive or indistinct.
Yeah. I mean, there's that website is no longer online, but there used to be this article called, like, there was a satirical review of Ubisoft game, which is just like, you know, how all Ubisoft games are essentially the same now. They've started diverging in the last couple of years, but for a while there, Watch Dogs was indistinguishable from Assassin's Creed, which is indistinguishable from Far Cry. And it got to the point of ridiculousness where the crew even had essentially radio towers to unlock. That's a freaking racing game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's there's definitely been a sort of a trend towards homogenization in the whole, like, 3D open world-ish kind of genre. And it's good to see people deviate from that.
On my own notes for this, I literally wrote fewer baldy gruff guys.
Yeah, I completely agree that, you know, there should be protagonists from like all backgrounds and whatnot, just because it variety is a spice of life. And I still like me some, you know, some short brown haired gruff guys every now and then. Like, I'm still down with Adam Jensen, you know.
Yeah.
But It's good to get that variety.
Yeah, I don't know if this is misandry or not, but I am more likely to want to play the game if I have the option to play the game with a female avatar.
Yeah, that's not misandry. That's just like, you know, there's so many dudes out there. Like, it's good to get variety, especially because, you know, there are a lot fewer women protagonists than male protagonists in games.
Yeah,
that can definitely be a point of hype, is knowing that you can play as somebody who, you know, looks like you or just looks like somebody that you don't see a lot. Like, you're right, there's a lot of white dudes with short hair, but, like, you know, maybe I want to play as an Asian man or I want to play as a black woman. It's just like, I want to, that would hype me up to be able to see, like, oh my god, I can play as somebody different. Like, I'm sick of playing, I don't know, maybe sick is wrong, but I'm just tired of playing as, you know, white dudes all the time.
I was going to say Marcus Fenix, basically, but maybe less shaped like a refrigerator.
Yeah.
When it comes to Marcus... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, like, the thing with The Witcher 3 and Geralt kind of sucking, like, that's kind of the thing. It's like, growly voiced white dude, like, come on. And
then, I hate Geralt.
It just put me off. even though, like, The Witcher 3 seemed like the kind of game I would love, like, I started it up and I just couldn't. And I don't know that it was all the protagonists. Sometimes it takes me a while to get into a game, and I didn't get to that threshold. But yeah, that the main character really put me off.
I've talked about it a lot here, but one of the things about Geralt that kills me is not just him, but it's the people's reactions to him. Like, if you come across, like, a female NPC, it's like, oh, I wish I could just fuck him right now. And it's like, wait, you know what I mean? It's, like, so out of place. It's like, yeah. What? You know, and if you come across a guy, it's more like, oh, I wish I could be him. And then, then unless they're scripted to hate him for some reason, everybody has these weird reactions to him. And it's just, it's so annoying just even walking into new areas in The Witcher because of everybody's weird little, they either have a Witcher fetish or they want to murder him in the streets. There's not much of a go-between.
Yeah, that was like the opening scene, or one of the opening scenes. It's like Geralt just had sex with his hot woman and she's still naked in his bed or something like that. It's like, come the fuck on.
Yeah, like, at least build up to that. Or just make him like a complete Lothario who's just like fucking his way across the Witcher Kingdom. Like, well, so basically, go one way or the other.
So basically, what if Leisure Suit Larry went to Tamriel?
Yeah, I would be down for that game. Like, there are not enough satirical fantasy games.
Well, do you remember, like, kind of how Ezio was in early Assassin's Creed? Like, I think that's kind of how you can do that kind of right. Like, he's kind of a goofy, like, yeah, maybe ladies love him, but 90% of that's in his own head. And he's just kind of like a goofy guy who's charming in his own way. But, you know, he's not anything like Geralt, where it's just like, hello, welcome to the inn, sir. Can I immediately go sleep with you? I don't know.
Also, you mentioned this with Mass Effect, but, like, you know, we had three games to see Ezio go from being, you know, a lovable, hot-blooded Italian caricature to basically someone who kind of thought he was still being a lovable, hot-blooded Italian caricature, but was kind of getting too old. That's someone who was kind of recognizing his age and is in, like, kind of the end of his life. I do think I've never played a Witcher game, but hearing all of you talking about it makes me kind of think of, did you ever see, like, those original box art for, like, the old Elder Scrolls games? Like, not, like, Morrowind, but, like, the really old ones? Like
Daggerfall or Arena?
Yeah, and how they would always kind of, they would basically look like Conan comics with, like, the women would be in, like, chainmail bikinis and the men would all be in, like, small loincloths. And part of me is thinking that, like, as much as The Witcher wants to be this, like, socially, you know, conscious, really smart game, it probably always is kind of going to be the, like kind of pervy, weird game from 2007.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a place for that in the gaming sphere. Don't get me wrong. It's just,
oh yeah, yeah.
I don't know if I want to keep. I don't know if that necessarily appeals to me.
Yeah.
Like, I like a good sex scene in a video game, but, you know, there's a little nuance to it that perhaps was lacking in The Witcher and various other games.
Oh, pretty much every game. Like, I mean, I guess it's not as bad as the sex scene from Fahrenheit, which has, like, quick time events.
Well, I mean,
I'm not even making that up. It has, like, it's not just, like, press X to unhook bra. It's, like, press this sequence of 20 buttons to unhook bra.
On the other hand, Merv, it is a David Cage game, so the fact that it was presumably consensual is probably the best we're going to get out of him.
Yeah, David Cage is strange. I don't like to rag on David Cage too much because I've only played half of one of his games. So I don't really have a leg to stand on in the whole making fun of David Cage thing. I'll even go as far as to say that he's kind of right about the whole polygon sequel emotion thing. But he's the worst person to make that point. Like, if you got Neil Druckmann out there on stage saying, yeah, polygon equals emotions, compare Uncharted 4 to Uncharted 1, I would say, yes, you've made the point. But David Cage making that point?
That I don't think Druckmann would basically just say, like, oh, now would talk in a way that implies we should just throw out everything from, like, 5 years ago.
That's true.
But that's, yeah, I didn't mean to get off on that David Cage thing. Sorry.
I mean, if you want to know what strategy works to get me not hyped for a game, get David Cage to sell it to me. Yeah, so like one thing that really – there are two things that I think work for me really well. One is show me gameplay footage. It's very hard to get me excited about a new big-budget title if I don't know what it plays like. Indie games I'm willing to take more of a gamble on. Like if it's just something looks just kind of cool, yeah, I'll throw a tenner at it. No problem. But for a big-budget game that I'm going to be spending, you know, $60, $70 on – I want to know what I'll be doing in it. And so showing off gameplay, like live streaming before the game comes out, you know, lengthy gameplay demos, things like that. Just to give an example from last year, I was not going to buy Nier Automata. I was like, oh, this looks okay. And then Sony just put out this half hour gameplay demo of it. And it showed them riding around on a moose. I'm like, oh, you can ride on a moose in this game? I have to buy it. And it ended up being my favorite game of 2017. So, you know, you never know what it is that will trigger that response to say, yes, I'm going to go out and buy a game, but gameplay helps for sure. The other thing I was going to mention is dole out information, you know, every now and then. Don't announce a game and then go radio silent for 3 years and then say, oh yeah, this is coming out, because I'll have forgotten about your game by then.
So, yeah.
It worked for Fortnite, though.
Fortnite's still not out.
is it still technically early access?
Yeah, it's still early access. Yeah.
Wow.
It's made way more money than most games that come out fully released.
You know, I think kind of getting to one of the questions that you were asking is, are there different strategies for different games? And I got to say, yeah, for an RPG, I want to see a lot more before it's going to enter my radar, especially a new one. I needed to see a lot from, like, let's say Pillars of Eternity, you know, to kind of feel like I could really buy into what they were selling. Whereas for a shooter, I just need some good gameplay. If you can just talk to me in the language of how shooters work for the most part, I'm good. But yeah, I definitely need more complex stuff, I think, for RPGs than for other games.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I haven't watched everything that's come out for Anthem so far, but, Anthem, I assume is supposed to appeal to the people who like Dragon Age and Mass Effect, which would be me. And I watched the trailer for it, and it's not really gameplay. It's just kind of like an animated, and I was just completely ambivalent towards the trailer. Like,
well, if you want to talk about Anthem, that's kind of where this topic came from. And as a shooter fan, I also feel ambivalent towards Anthem for what they showed me from the shooting. It's very sloppy. One of the things I was talking about with Anthem is it's kind of existing in a space right now where there's two big players, Destiny and Division, right? Division's a covered-based shooter. It's got the numbers. It's more RPG. Destiny's a very fluid combat. You're running from place to place, but fights only usually take 10, 20, 30 seconds, you know, unless you're talking about a boss or something. So when I'm seeing Anthem and I'm looking at the gameplay language of that as a shooter, I'm like, this is the worst of both worlds. It's literally just someone standing there holding down the trigger. It's like MMO-style combat in a shooter, which, like, you know, talking about from a shooter fan, that's the worst of both worlds. You know, I don't want that at all. So when we're talking about Anthem, this is the game that's going to make or break BioWare. So when I see stuff like that being released in the gameplay trailer and people are trying to get hyped about it, it's a gorgeous-looking game. It looks really good, but it hasn't given me enough RPG stuff to sink my teeth into, and the shooting they showed me looked like B, C tier, you know? So how am I supposed to get hype about this game that I want to basically save one of my favorite companies? It's really hard, you know, so.
When is that? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go. No, please, Black.
I was just going to ask, when is Anthem due out, by the way?
February, I think.
Yeah, February 2019.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm sorry, continue.
February is a crowded month. It's not February used to be kind of a dumping grounds, but October's already packed, so they started shipping stuff off to the next quarter, which is February. And February's pretty packed, so if you're releasing against a lot of these other titans, and some that'll already be out, like Battlefield 5, Call of Duty, you know, in the shooter space is going to be crammed from the end of this year on. You know, I don't know where the spot for Anthem is, and Anthem has me more worried about the company making it than any game ever. Yeah. So
it's worth noting Andromeda came out the same month as Horizon Zero Dawn, Breath of the Wild, and a few weeks after Nier Automata. This is coming out the same week as Crackdown 3, The Division 2, a few other stuff. Like,
same week as The Division 2 is not a good idea.
Yeah, and Division 2 is, I don't know how much you guys have followed the life cycle of Division, but Division came out, it was pretty good. It was pretty well received, kind of had a dip for a while where like the stuff they were releasing wasn't keeping up pace with some of the other stuff. But in the last 3 or 4 months, people have been loving Division. It's had a huge resurgence. It's almost a unique Ubi phenomenon right now, right? Like where they're supporting games well into their life cycle. So Division's got plenty of hype around it to just basically throw your new established IP up against Division, I think is a really foolish move.
I mean, if they want to make fiscal 2018, they should just delay it by a month, and it'll still be in
December.
March.
December, or December, the other way, is what I was thinking.
I was actually wrong. March 15th is when The Division 2 is coming out.
Okay, so it's not that bad.
Yeah, it's a few weeks,
So then they really need to make sure they hit that February date, because if they delay it to March, then they're screwed.
Anthem's a new IP, so you got to think that there's going to be a week or two lag. People are going to want to see reviews. People are going to want to see game. You know what I mean? So I don't know. It's still kind of a weird window to me. But Anthem, to me, is a really weird spot right now. I want it to be amazing, and I want BioWare to basically use it to leverage their way out of EA's kind of, you know, doghouse back into making whatever game they feel like making. But I think everybody – it's a widely known secret, I think, that if this game flops, this is it for BioWare.
It's – at this point, I don't – like, Anthem is not for me, and I know that going in. It's weird to sort of be really interested in the fate of a game that you're not going to play. Like, I want Dragon Age 4 to get made. The only way it gets made is if Anthem succeeds.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, actually, that was kind of with me and Metal Gear Solid 5. I wasn't really interested in what I was seeing, but I was hoping that it would be okay. Like, I was hoping that Kojima was going to... I guess, actually, it's more Death Stranding, which I'll probably play, but regardless of whether I do or not, I hope it does well just because I want Kojima to be able to do stuff he wants to do.
So, speaking of the hype cycle... The whole hype cycle for Death Stranding is one that I don't really understand.
Oh my god. I don't understand anything about this game.
So I've never played a Kojima game. So I'm not the audience for this, maybe. But this game was announced how many years ago? 2-3 years ago now? I still don't know what you do in the game.
Yeah.
And that's concerning.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Kojima games, the best I can explain it, I'm not super deep into Kojima games. I'm a very surface level Kojima fan, but the games themselves are usually really fun. The gameplay, I mean, you can play Metal Gear Solid and not get into all the craziness behind the scenes and still have a good time playing it. I don't know if you're going to be able to do that with Death Stranding. I think this game is going to be him sticking all that la-le-li-lo-lu stuff on top of you and being like defying you. Like, basically challenging the player in the language, in the way he talks, Kojima, like, his gameplay language, to just, you have no other choice but to deal with his craziness. It was always in the background in the Metal Gear series. You know, you didn't have to get into all the crazy language of the battlefield stuff in Metal Gear Solid 5. It was just there, but, you know, every one of his games has, like, a unifying feature. He says, I never notice them half the time, but... So I think this is going to be the first game where he doesn't have that layer of, well, yeah, the gameplay is going to be really, really good, so you can ignore all this other crazy shit going on. And it's going to be really interesting to see how people react to that, because I think 75% of the public is going to be like, I don't want to be carrying a box up hills for hours, which is so far what we at least know happens in this game. But if he's saying, you know, well, carrying the boxes is symbolic of war refugees or whatever,
fair, the box does have a baby in it.
Yeah, so. Exactly. But who knows what goes on with it. But yeah, I feel like this is the first time you're going to have nothing to do game-wise other than deal with what he wants to say to you through his narrative. And I think people are going to have one of two reactions to that. And I don't know. We'll see what it ends up being.
Yeah, I think a lot of this could be mitigated, though, if like he weren't so focused on confusing people before.
I don't think
release.
The thing is, though, I mean, he is, but in more of this, that's something that kind of happened with Metal Gear Solid 2 is, for those of you who don't know, in the Metal Gear series, you traditionally play as a hero called Solid Snake, who is this like kind of mixture of 80s action heroes character. In Metal Gear Solid 2, though, for part of the plot to work the way it does, Snake couldn't be the main character. They replaced him with a character named Raiden, who was sort of meant to be in the plot. Basically, Raiden goes through a story vaguely similar to the first Metal Gear Solid, because the whole point of the game is that he's unwittingly being trying to be turned into a new Solid Snake by basically being set up as a new Metal Gear game. But to hide this, and specifically because Raiden was meant as this kind of difficult and not super likable character, the demos that Konami and Kojima sent out to the press actually didn't show that. It actually featured altered levels that weren't in the final game. The gameplay was still similar, but it gave them it basically kind of lied about what the actual plot that would be in the game in order to kind of hide this early game reveal. And I think since then, he's tried to avoid having his demos be actively, like, spoil the plot, so they're more, like, thematically similar, like how in P.T., the demo for what was going to be his and Guillermo del Toro's Silent Hills, that probably would have never happened in the actual game. It was to show you the themes of how it worked.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair approach to take to demoing a game or hyping it up. Yeah. I think confusing was probably the wrong word to use for earlier. It's not so much confusing as it is obfuscating.
It's very purposeful. It you know, I think a lot of people, I think that myself included, that I've talked to about this game, they like the idea of Kojima, like that there's this auteur style guy out there doing his own thing and he doesn't care if you're confused or not, type thing, you know, but it's going to be weird to see how it actually pans out in gameplay, because that kind of challenge your audience thing in games typically isn't very successful. But I think you're right. It's not that we're confused. It's that he wants us to be. And the reaction that we're giving to Death Stranding, there's no way he could have put out those trailers and be like, oh, they're going to get this. This is all right. It makes so much sense. No, he knows what he's doing. So, yeah, it's pretty purposeful.
Yeah. I mean, okay, like, to bring this back, I think different things work on different people, and obfuscation makes people intrigued, makes some people intrigued, and it frustrates other people like me.
Yeah. So, it's also how it's done.
Double-edged sword. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's also how it's done. Like, I think Kojima, for the most part, can do it well. I think there are other times, and I'm sorry, because I can't really think of one off the top of my head that actually, one that I think worked decently for people was the newly announced Sekiro Shadows Die Twice, the latest FromSoft game.
Yeah.
Because all you saw first was like a very grisly but still kind of confusing cinematic that just kind of told you that the death, the pain, and the emphasis on like the human body would be a focus.
Yeah, but like that communicates, I think, the themes that it's going for quite effectively. And then, you know, other information about it sort of immediately followed that, yeah, this would be another action RPG, the vein of sort of Dark Souls-ish, so, or I guess more Bloodborne-ish is what they're going for this time. So, you know, we knew what it was, we knew what the game was presenting within a few hours of that trailer being shown at E3. So it's a similar approach in that, yeah, they're being very coy about the plot, and they're just giving general thematic ideas, but you know, they're being very upfront about what we'll actually be doing in that game. So it sometimes works.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
So speaking of these sort of these hype cycles, which ones actually kind of worked really well for you, even for games that necessarily weren't expecting to get into?
I'll start. Arkham City, I think, was probably the one the recent one I can think of that really kind of knocked it out of the park for me. I don't know if you guys remember the Arkham City. There was a little bit of a controversy with, they had a lot of pre-order bonuses out there. You know, it was like one of those 10 different ones, but they showed a lot of like alternative outfits early on. And then they started to do kind of like a series of videos with the different villains that would be in there, I think. And then they released like a little iOS game, that where you fought those villains. It just kind of like they had kind of like a rolling marketing plan that felt more like they were trying to reintroduce the game when we pretty much knew what it was, but they were showing you a lot of the stuff like, okay, you're actually going to be playing the whole city this time. And I think that's what everybody wanted. They had like a comic book run up into it. So it was basically was like one of those full fledged marketing campaigns across everything. You know, you had comics, you had videos, you had basically everything. And then everything they were showing me was more of what I wanted to see. So every time I would see something, it was like, wow, okay, I'm actually exploring a city now. I'm not just confined to the asylum. So while everything it was showing me was, yeah, you're getting exactly what you wanted. More is better, and here's what it looks like. And on top of that, new villains and lots of other cool stuff. So that was one that I really just remember standing out as one that it hit all those marks for me.
Yeah. One that had hit the mark for me, and I think Kappa will kind of agree with this, is Planet Coaster actually worked really well for me.
Yeah.
And it's similar in that, well, they didn't have, you know, all this tie-in material to show off. They did the thing where they showed off work in progress, right? But instead of showing off work in progress that would change, they showed off work in progress that they were going to improve. So they showed off, you know, oh, here's a prototype for a certain kind of merry-go-round. But when we complete it, it's going to look better because we're going to add some more detail work to it. And then they made good on that promise. So I'm generally not a huge fan of devs showing off work in progress, but Planet Coaster is the rare exception that we're actually
working. That's pretty par for the course from I'm blanking on the name. Frontier. Yeah, I mean, because even Eve, Elite Dangerous, they kind of did some of the same stuff. They would show like, hey, here's a ship we're working on. It may or may not make it to the game, but here's the ideas behind this ship. And they talk in a lot of like they talk development style in a lot of those videos where it's like, we want this ship's role to be this, and it fits in the gap between these two ships. And we know there's a lot of people out there who are on a budget who want to get into exploration, and that's what this ship is for. So when you start to hear kind of like stuff like that, it feels refreshing because it's like, okay, this dev at least knows his game well enough to know where the gaps are and what's going on. And I really like that. I thought that was pretty interesting. Frontier is I think, a really, really underrated gaming company right now.
Yeah, I mean, they just made Jurassic World Evolution, which you love, so.
I do.
Yeah. Other hype cycles that work for you guys that have drawn you into a game?
Well, there's actually three. I mentioned Smash, and that really works for me, but I'll talk about it later, if that's okay, because I just want to do one quick example, which is that Assassin's Creed 3, Grand Theft Auto 5, and Saints Row the Third were ones that really worked on me, and I ended up really disliking the games when they came out. I just thought that they were showing a lot of cool ideas, and there was a lot of like energy, and when I got into all of those, I just found them. Well, I found Assassin's Creed to be just this massive slog, and Saints Row the Third to be far less funny than it thought it was, and GTA 5 to just really grind my gears. And that,
yeah, I had a similar experience to GTA 5, but I think I felt more comfortable saying that it didn't work for me because it had been out for a while at that point.
Yeah.
And sort of all the hot takes had already come in. So at that point, I was just like, yeah, this is really unpleasant.
Yeah. Since that, they kind of, aside from kind of hurting a lot of my interest in open world games, they also are what really killed a lot of my interest in hype cycles. So,
yeah, like at a certain point, once you're kind of burned by a game, you're just like, I don't believe in any of this hype anymore. That's what happened with me in Watch Dogs, actually. Because I think, like a lot of other people, they showed off that trailer, I think, was it E3 2013, 2014, a while ago?
With the iconic jacket?
Yeah, the iconic hat, yeah. You know, they showed off that gameplay footage, and it looked incredible. And then they showed off more gameplay footage, and it still looked pretty good. And then the game came out, and it was a total slog. And now I'm, you know, skeptical of open world crime games, where before I just, you know, picked them up almost sight unseen, because that worked for Sleeping Dogs, which I'd seen even less of before release, and it ended up being one of my favorite games of last gen. And now I thought the same would happen with Watch Dogs, and no such
thing. Watch Dogs 2 was so fun, though.
Yeah, I've heard.
Getting into like kind of what you're talking about, though, like downgrades are such a thing now, and I'm not like I'm not the kind of person who like is talking about graphical downgrades. To me, that's kind of, if you've been gaming for more than a couple of years, you should expect graphical downgrades between E3. What do they call them? Bull shots or something like that? There's a funny name for them. So, like, you know, you should expect graphical downgrades. I think every company, even, you know, people love CDPR. They did the same thing for Witcher. Everybody graphically downgrades between E3 and what you actually play. What I'm talking more about is like an overpromising scenario, like No Man's Sky, where you basically promise the world and know that that's not going to be in your game. To me, that is like, that should be the death knell for any game, is if you came out there and you said stuff was going to be in your game, and then you just fail completely to deliver. I feel like that's a very dangerous, you know, marketing strategy to go with, is to way over promise and hope that people buy it, and then just kind of pull the rug out from them and say stuff like maybe in a patch or maybe in a DLC. That to me is a mistake.
So No Man's Sky is an interesting case, because almost everything they promised is in the game now.
Right, yeah.
2 years after the fact, right? So like, it just proves that that game, either they should have underpromised or they should have spent 2 more years developing it. I guess they didn't have the budget to spend 2 more years developing it.
Yeah, but when somebody puts together like a very damning, I think it was on Reddit, they basically posted all the stuff that had been promised in this game, like feature by feature, with like quotes from what's his name, Sean
Murray.
Yeah, so they went line by line and said, he said this was going to be in the game, and then they said, as of blank, it's not in the game. And they just went line by line, and it's like, man, when you see all the stuff that was promised in that game and what actually shipped, I mean, that's no matter what, that crushes hype, and I think No Man's Sky definitely was one of the biggest victims of that in recent memory of that.
Yeah, like generating too much hype can backfire, and I think this is the kind of game that would have benefited from early access if they really needed the cash infusion to keep developing. But I don't think you can do early access on PlayStation. So,
except when it's Fortnite, apparently.
Is Fortnite on PS4?
Yeah, and it's not crossplay. You haven't kept up with
that? Yeah. Oh, that, my God. That whole nonsense. that apparently, if you ever used your Epic account to play Fortnite on PS4, you cannot use it to play Fortnite on Switch or Xbox.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a hot load of bullshit. And Sony should be ashamed, but they don't need to be ashamed because they're making money hand over fist. So.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, if anything kills... So that's the other thing. Sometimes stuff that happens outside the regular hype cycle kills hype. And this case, like how Sony has been behaving over the past few years, has made me less hyped for a potential PS5.
Oh, 100%. It's gonna happen exactly what happened last cycle. It's gonna flip again. It'll be a Microsoft generation or whatever Microsoft does with their next console. But yeah, it's gonna flip again. And I don't know how people don't learn lessons of the past, but Microsoft will probably do the same shit they did, and we'll be right back to where we're.
Yeah, it'll just go right back to Sony for the PS6. And here's the thing: if Microsoft, and it seems like they're trying to do this now, like based on Microsoft going full Weeaboo at E3, like Microsoft is trying to establish a foothold in Japan and is kind of failing at it. If Microsoft ever starts nabbing those games that I like that appear only on PS4, like if Microsoft starts getting Digimon games, then I don't have to buy a PS5, you know?
Yeah. So, and the fact that I own a gaming PC and an Xbox right now, Microsoft is making really strong cases for me not to buy a PS5 as well.
Yeah, but like I said, it's going to come down to exclusives, and PlayStation has pretty much on all of those.
Yeah.
That I really want to play. So I end up going PlayStation, even though I don't like the console's practices.
Well, didn't they just announce that they're at least making a bunch of their exclusives available for PC, like in the fourth quarter this year, and first quarter for 2019?
Yeah, the Yakuza games are coming to PC.
Wow.
And Horizon Zero Dawn, I think, is... in 2018. I thought it was a PS4 exclusive, which was frustrating because the logistics of that, we have a PS4, but that's like Mr. Jackson's system and the PC is my system. So like
maybe in the sense that PS4 emulation is getting there. Maybe that's I don't think Xbox emulation will ever quite get there, but PS4 emulation is still coming along. But maybe that's what they were talking about. I don't think Horizon's coming to PC.
Okay. I'm going to stop right there for a second. This is the article that says this, that they're going to release their titles on PC in 2018 and 2019, is an April Fool's joke.
Oh, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
It's April 1st, 2018.
Oh, I didn't even see the freaking thing.
Dark Side of Gaming. So the Yakuza games actually are coming to PC. Zero and Kiwami, but unfortunately no Zero Dawn or Order. 1886.
You know,
why would they do such a thing?
To get people's hopes up and dash them expertly.
Yeah. Some April Fool's jokes are kind of... It should be a rule that you should have to take down your April Fool's jokes after April 1st.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't even look at the fucking day on the article when I saw it. Because, like, I've been anxious to play Horizon Zero Dawn, but I just... it's so annoying.
Yeah. Fuck you, Dark Side of Gaming. Anyway. Go ahead, Kappa.
No, I think Wolfman was trying to talk.
Sorry, Wolfman, what are you trying to say?
No, I was going to just say, just put, like, in 20... point font, just saying this was an April Fool's joke.
They're never gonna do that.
Talking about the hype cycle though, just like if we could make changes to it, I think probably across the board everybody would say shorten it, right? I mean, isn't that the answer to hitting the right amount of hype? Do you guys remember when they announced, what was it, Fallout 3, and it was announced and they were like, oh yeah, it's coming out in 3 months. Was that Fallout 4? Yeah. And like people were blown away. And it was like, you just announced this game and told me it's coming out in 3 months. That was a big way to do it. And I think that's kind of the future. I don't necessarily know if you need 2 years of hype building, 3 years of hype building. I think you can get a lot done in 4 or 5 months if it's a series that people know and people want more of. It's kind of weird to me that we're still seeing these really, really long hype cycles for games like Merv was saying early on, you lose a lot of hype if you announce it and then you don't hear anything about the game for 3 years. I can list games that we were excited about. Do you guys remember there was a Capcom Dark Souls game?
Deep Down.
Yeah. Where's that? Yeah. You know, like
that's probably in development hell.
Yeah. But yeah. There's a lot of games like that where why invest all this marketing and hype building and time at E3 when you don't even know if the game's going to come out? Give me games that are, you know, at most a year out. No more of these.
I only paid attention to the Nintendo conference because I was writing stuff up on it for Source Gaming. Final Fantasy VII, the remake, didn't get shown
at all,
right?
No.
Yeah, figured as much.
Yeah, it's,
people are going to forget about it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm sure that there's some marketing study somewhere that says here's the right amount of time, but I think from a gamer's perspective, I'm not getting hyped for anything that's 3 years down the line. You know, I mean, like, it's cool to know, like, there's a new Elder Scrolls out, but I think most of us assumed it, but it's hard for me to build any kind of, you know, level of hype for it past, you know, I'm glad it's coming. But that's across the board for games we know are coming, you know?
Yeah. Like, it's a little bit of a balancing act, because if you announce, like, a new IP and say it's coming out in 3 months, that might not be enough, because people have already sort of penciled it on their calendars what they're going to be playing when.
Right.
But, yeah, for an established IP, yeah, 6 months down the line, this is coming out, sure.
The one example I did say Elder Scrolls, but the fact that they announced it was next gen, I think kind of makes it sense that they announced that one when they announced it then, so that people can kind of calm down about when you're going to announce Skyrim 2 or whatever, and they say, look, this thing is down the line, but it's going to look gorgeous and it's going to be next gen. But yeah, other than that, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't hear anything else about that game until, like, yeah, it's ready to come out now. So yeah, I don't know. I think shorter is better, and I think the other thing, if I could fix most hype cycles, you got to start it with some type of gameplay. So at least, even if it's just, God, I hate them, but I mean, you know, the thing where it's like, hey Mary, there's some ammo over there. Let's go check it out. Oh no, a monster's attacked. You know, like those voiceover gameplay things that they do.
Like the chatting that nobody ever actually, the way that nobody ever actually chats.
Yeah, exactly. Like a bunch of PR people chatting as they play. I'm fine with that, but I mean, you've got to show me some gameplay.
So, like, I understand why they can't, like, have actual voices, because the way I chat with friends, A, there's a lot more cursing, and B, it's usually, like, we play on, like, the easiest difficulty settings, so we could just, like, chat about random crap while we play. So it'll be like, you know, oh, hey, David, long time no chat. How's the wife? You know,
hang on. Steve's dropping in. Steve, what's up, dude? We're doing the mission. Are you ready, Steve? Yes, I'm ready for the mission, guys. Let's go.
you see the contrast, right?
Yeah.
No, like, we like chatting about, like, complaining about work while we're shooting zombies. It's not how you can't show that off at an E3 conference, unfortunately. to get back to the length of hype cycles. You know what franchise actually did this really well? Unravel.
Yeah.
So when they announced their first game of the series, they announced it about like a year before released, and then Unravel 2, they announce it, comes out that day.
Yeah, they're like, go play it now.
Yeah. So it works if you got like an established IP. If they'd done the same thing with the first Unravel, I would have been like, what the hell is this, right? But it worked well for Unravel 2. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Worked both ways. Another thing I'd change about the hype cycle, cinematic trailers. I get why they exist, but they don't sell me on games.
Mm-hmm. No.
Sorry, go ahead, Fox.
Oh, no, I'm just agreeing emphatically with you.
Yeah, sometimes they're even nice to look at in and of themselves, but, like,
pair them with gameplay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, show exactly. You can show me a cinematic, and then, okay, here's some dude punching another dude, or here's some lady commanding her forces on the battlefield. You know, like, show me something, show me something in addition to the cinematic.
Yeah, I think in some ways the gameplay trailer has become its own separate thing now. You know, it's like you see the teaser, then you see the CGI trailer, and then 6 months down the line you finally get the gameplay trailer in, like, the way that the current hype cycles work, right? So
yeah, but
I'd say you could just lop 6 months off of that
yeah,
the gameplay trailer.
Yeah, I think most people would be fine with that. But by the time we get the gameplay trailer, it's like, oh, this is what we're going to be doing. Death Stranding. We still haven't seen that. You know?
And we've seen in-engine footage, too, so it's just really weird.
You know what was really weird, too, at E3? We kind of touched on it, but, they showed Spider-Man. Spider-Man's coming out real soon. And they showed it with no HUD, and they didn't they showed gameplay, but not really gameplay. That was a really weird hybrid trailer, if you think about it, because you didn't see a HUD, you didn't see the button prompts. It looked very cinematic, right? But then after the show, they showed basically the same thing, but they showed it with the HUD, and you're like, oh, these are all QTEs, you know? It all of a sudden made sense. Spider-Man wasn't just flying through this area looking effortless, you know, but no, some guy's pushing triangle, circle, square, or whatever, which is kind of a weird thing. It's not bad or good. It's just, I wonder what the idea behind that is, to show gameplay, but not really, you know, show kind of like a mix of it.
Didn't they do the same with Ghost of Tsushima as well? They didn't show, they didn't use the HUD. So go ahead, Wolf.
No, I was just going to say, it's kind of really not much more than it's fairer than what I guess is commonly now called bullshot, the idea of using cinematic trailers to disguise as actual gameplay trailers. But, it still is, I feel like that doesn't fully count. It's, QTE sequences. They're fine to have, but that shouldn't be, the only gameplay you have.
Yeah, you know what they should have shown off? They showed off sort of secondary, less flashy gameplay in another video that they released around E3 time, and that's what sold me on the game. Oh, this is basically Batman, Batman Arkham, but with Spider-Man.
Oh yeah, it's Batman for sure. But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all the last few Spider-Man games are.
Yeah. So I'm cool with that, but you know, be upfront about it instead of trying to hide the HUD, you know. But it does look really good. It's just it's not necessarily what people were expecting. And sometimes, going back to obfuscation, when you kind of hide what the game's about, you let people form ideas in their head of what they think they're going to be doing, and you show them what they're actually doing, and it doesn't match up with what they thought they'd be doing. It can annoy them, right? Yeah. Whereas if you're just upfront with what they're doing, then people don't build an image of the game in their heads. It's not accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, all of these things are double-edged swords. You have to be careful not to, you know, reveal too much, because then people won't be interested. But you do have to take care to explain what you're going to be doing. So to wrap this up, the one topic that we haven't touched on yet is, nowadays, the internet has made talking about games with other people, often many, many other people, very easy, which it wasn't back in the pre-internet days when we were all on the playground and you heard about video game rumors from somebody's uncle who works at Nintendo. So
instead, now those persons go on 4chan.
Yeah. Yeah, let's forget about that cesspit for a little bit. So I guess what I wanted to get your thoughts on is how you think that, you know, being able to meet with the community online has influenced the way you get hyped about video games.
In general, I'm kind of more negative on it a lot of the time. But one thing that can be really useful is that it provides the option for outside observers to kind of call out ideas that aren't so great. Like, for me, the standout here is, you remember the Tomb Raider reboot in 2013?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Early on in kind of like that game's hype cycle, there were the primary emphasis was on Lara Croft being the subject and victim of a sizable amount of violence, which is kind of in the game and really makes it a really grim experience. But that was also included sexual violence, because repeatedly throughout those trailers, Lara would be
there's one instance of it in one of the trailers.
Yeah, threatened with sexual assault. That people kind of rightfully were very aggressive about that as being this very gross thing that they were doing, and
yeah,
It's still there, but it is toned down a lot in the final release. And
what I'd say, it's not even that it changed from the trailer to the release. It's that it's a really weird thing to market a game with.
Yeah.
And it makes like it makes sense in the context of the game, but like at the risk of being really crude, rape doesn't sell me on a video game. So yeah, it was a really bizarre thing for them to do, and sort of they're just like one of their execs made some really kind of tasteless remarks about how they want Claire to protect Lara, which is a little bit patronizing and condescending. Yeah, but like it again, this is all stuff that made sense in the actual product that was released. But when you're dealing with this kind of subject matter, you have to be careful how you market.
And that's kind of true. And I don't think that they're – when I played the game, I think my initial reaction was, oh, this is what they made a big deal out of. But then I thought, well, why was that used as marketing then? Do you know what I mean? Because somebody saw that moment was like, we can make a big deal out of this. And that's almost worse. Do you know what I mean? That like we're gonna basically titillate them with a rape scene. Well, why? It makes no sense in the context of anything else. You know, it's like a once in a moment thing that, like you're saying, it does make sense, but then why pull that one moment out and use that? It makes no sense. It's crazy.
Well, there is a demographic that appeals that would appeal to.
That's true.
Sadly.
Yeah. Hence the people excited over Project Octopath.
Yeah, like again, I don't begrudge people their enjoyment of whatever they want to enjoy. Like, if you want to enjoy that sort of stuff on your own time, that's great. But, like, I don't – controversial things like that don't hold mass appeal. And it's weird that some marketers think they do.
Yeah. But there's a flip.
What's the issue with Octopath? I haven't heard anything.
Basically, in the demo, there is one of, so the game is basically a group of like playable characters, as you do in a lot of classic RPGs. And one of the characters, and they have different, you know, classes, and one of them is what's called a dancer. But then in the demo, it's shown that really is more like a prostitute who is being sexually abused by her pimp. And it's a really kind of gross moment that, like, the people making the game at Square don't really seem to they don't seem to understand why people are having the problems with it that they do, or that they are okay with that.
Yeah, sometimes I feel people throw things into games because they think it's grim and edgy, and they don't really fully understand the implications. And that's I don't want to be the kind of like cop who's like, don't put this in your game, because I think that that's sort of going too far. But at the same time, if you're going to deal with these issues, you should at least try to deal with them in a sensitive way. Like, actually deal with them. Don't just make them garnish. And it feels like sometimes this sort of grim and gritty stuff, especially sexual violence or torture, tends to be garnish instead of the meat.
You mean like sense. That attempted rape scene of Quiet in which Metal Gear was it?
Oh my god, five. Oh my god.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it because I haven't played that game, but yeah, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Or Quiet is just
also
David Cage.
I mean, you know, she breathes through her skin, so it's all fair game, right?
That's literally how they described it. Oh, it's okay. She's a plant.
Yeah, I sometimes I do think that people aren't willing to grapple with like fully with the implications of what they're putting in their games, and that's unfortunate. Yeah. So anything else you guys want to mention about how community has influenced the way you think about video game hype?
I think there's also the opposite kind of issue where when people or fans are demanding features that they either think they want or that they know they've liked in the past. Like, one of the issues that I had with Andromeda, and I also think this is a problem with Mass Effect 3, is a sense that the people making the game really wanted to, you know, cater to and support, you know, the loyal fans who cared about their product. But I think and sometimes this would come to decisions or mechanics or storytelling elements that weren't necessarily really satisfying or weren't really well done, but were done to kind of like give the fans what they wanted. And I think that the community having like greater access and a larger voice can lead to that.
There's one thing.
Can you give examples from Andromeda? Because I'm not familiar with it.
Oh yeah. One of the things that I was kind of frustrated by is that a lot of the time you'll meet characters who weren't in the previous Mass Effect games, but like new people who were in the previous Mass Effect.
Oh yeah, I've heard of this. Yeah.
So like, there's one side quest where you meet Finn. I'm sorry, Flaxen, for potentially spoiling this. Where you meet, there's a side quest where you meet some Cerberus people.
Mm. Okay.
And they talk about how like how dumb and silly all of the like previous Cerberus experiments were, but in games where you actually dealt with those and they were serious, and it felt kind of like this weird like in joke that wouldn't really have made sense to anyone who just came into Andromeda alone.
So they're dropping all these hints to previous games, but
yeah, like Conrad Werner's sister. You meet her.
See, Conrad Werner strikes me as the kind of person who would kill his siblings and wear their skin as a suit. So I'm surprised his sister's still alive.
Yeah.
One thing community marketing wise I wanted to bring up is it's becoming more and more of a thing, and you're seeing it, I would say, with not AAA titles, but kind of, you know, that weird gap between AA and maybe, you know, whatever else is below it. But, paid streaming or paying streamers or influencers or content creators, whatever you want to call them, to play their games is a really, really weird thing to me. It makes a lot more sense when I see my kid and I guess his coming up generation, because that's who he – what matters to him, what makes a game popular, is whether the people he watches on YouTube are playing that game. That's it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if those people aren't playing those games, then it's not a popular game, period. So you get a lot of – I don't know if you guys are familiar with Darwin Project.
I know it exists.
So basically what it is, it's a battle royale game, of course. It's a smaller scale. I think it's like 10 players, and they have one person who's a director. And what the director does is control the fights. He gives buffs. He – you know, takes away buffs, he moves things, places things as the match goes to make the match more fun. And that's a really weird concept. So they were like, well, how do we explain what this is about? Well, we pay a bunch of streamers to go play this game, basically. And you could tell most of them weren't into it. You know, streamers, for the most part, they have their one game or their one niche, and that's all they play. But what this was trying to be was like, I don't know how to describe it, like, fake,
like a game
fake
for the streaming generation almost.
Right, but it's very fake hype. You know, it's like, aren't you guys hyped to play? You know, they're getting, you know, $5,000 to sit there and play this game for a couple hours. So, like, they made a tournament, and it's all these high-view popular streamers playing this game. And when you go into their Twitch chat, it's just scrolling chat like, this game sucks. Go back and play Fortnite. You know what I mean? Like, because that's what their viewers are there for. So it's such a tone-deaf thing to force this on the streamer. Well, not for the streamer to force this on his audience, to make more money in one way. But in the other way, I can really see that being the next generation of building hype is, hey, we pay PewDiePie to go play the new Assassin's Creed for 3 hours, and here's what he did, you know?
I'm honestly – the only thing surprising
– Yeah.
Yeah, the only thing surprising to me is that we're not already there.
Yeah, it's –
I mean, we are sort of already there. We even had a whole controversy about it where people weren't disclosing these payments and – the FTC, and it was apparently in violation of FTC rules, and now people have to disclose in their video descriptions very clearly whether or not they're paid to play a game.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things like where if you're trying to build your hype by paying popular streamers, I automatically assume there's something wrong with your game. I'm just going to tell you, like, straight up, I automatically assume, like, this shit is not going to be fun, because if you got to pay people to play it, like, the way it used to be was when you were a streamer, you know, way back in the before it was big money, is say, hey, man, I'll give you a code and you can play the game early. You get content. I get clicks. It works out for both of us. But if you've got to go so far as to pay people, yeah, I'm going to assume that your game sucks.
And this is why Sea of Thieves flopped.
Oh my god, that and about a trillion other reasons.
But yeah, it's definitely a strange phenomenon now that, you know, they're essentially paying people to do their marketing for them, and it's strange that it's almost a very hands-off thing that they're letting these people kind of build their marketing content for them. There's a lot of trust in that relationship that I think.
My specific example is, do you guys ever play Black Desert Online, the MMO? Heard about it?
I've heard of it because of its character creator.
Yeah, it's a very intricate game. Lots going on. The combat is way more like fighting game than MMO. And they paid Summit 1G to play the game for a couple weeks. And like, as well as paying him, they also gave him like really high tier armor and high tier gear and everything. And he's a very popular streamer. So they basically gave him not just the game for free and paid him. They more or less gave him cheat codes in an MMO. So he's running around there, you know, and it makes the game look worse if you think about it, because like, now here's this guy who doesn't know how to play this game and all this high gear armor and everything, who's not doing very good. And he eventually he raged out and quit the game because people were still killing him all the time, even though he had everything given to him. And I'm like, that was money really poorly spent. But I'm sure there's more and more and more examples of that out there.
Even if it turned out that he was good at the game, people would say, oh, this looks amazing, and not realize that they gave him all the high level gear. Then they go in and play the game and they suck at it.
Exactly.
And they're mad because they were misled. So either way, it would backfire on them. You know? So it is strange that they've taken this approach now to paying streamers, but I guess that's where we're at now.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on video game hype before we call this to a close?
Well, I was going to just say one thing.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Because one thing that I actually do enjoy, and admittedly because my relationship with the series is often tied to the hype cycle itself, is Super Smash Brothers.
Okay, yeah.
Because because it involves a few things. For one, the last few games have had a daily blog, kind of like every weekday it gets updated with some kind of thing. And sometimes these aren't like really particularly exciting things. A lot of the time it's just kind of very simple stuff, but it's often informative and it's often like very seeped in personality, because Smash is kind of the brainchild of Masahiro Sakurai, who has this like very eccentric personality that he really emphasizes in these games. Like, he has this sort of weird kind of loopy persona that like constantly shifts from being like very like braggadocious to very like kind of nerdy and technical.
Yeah, that comes across in some of the marketing materials.
Yeah, and it's very much gameplay focused. There is a use of like CGI trailers, but those are usually just used to kind of like set a tone. The emphasis is pretty much always on gameplay itself.
Yeah, so that's a good use of cinematics, where they're like, Okay, here's the character introductions. Now let's show you gameplay. So it sets the tone, and then it's like a layup, right? It sets the tone, and then the other guy spikes the gameplay spikes it.
Yeah, and
I've mixed like five sports there. Sorry.
Oh, it's it also helps because like Super Smash Brothers is a 2D fighting game, so you can't really do a lot with like actual storytelling in the action. So having those, like when something like Watch Dogs, you know, we talked about that. Like Watch Dogs is a 3D action game where all the characters have, you know, their mouths are supposed to mimic the syllables they're saying. Like, so there's not really a reason you have to use CGI trailers for that. This is something where, like, that actually serves a purpose.
Yeah. A lot of the characters don't have mouths, too.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Mr. Game & Watch, like, or Rob having a conversation.
Also, they can be fairly emotional. They actually managed to make Sad Rob.
Sad Rob.
Yeah.
He's a robot. He can't be sad.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, sorry. But yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, so Smash is interesting in that I think the developers and the marketers are kind of in tune with their community, and sort of give them are good at giving them what they want. I mean, there's a double-edged sword there. I think at E3, a lot of people who weren't who were only very maybe casual Smash fans might have been a little bit put off by the E3 presentation, but for people who are big Smash fans, that really spoke to them.
Yeah. It also it's also part of the issue is that it's a community that draws from so many other video game communities that
so it's if Nintendo fans meeting fighting game fans, meeting party game fans, and they're all under one tent.
But also individual fans of those Nintendo series who may not like other Nintendo series.
So they're why haven't you put 5 more characters from Metroid in here? Why did you put another Fire Emblem character?
It's a bit like herding cats.
Yeah, especially when different franchises have different levels of popularity in different parts of the world. Like in Japan, they're probably reacting very positively to the inclusion of more Fire Emblem characters. And out here in North America, we like our Metroid.
So. Yeah, although sometimes it even goes there where people will be complaining about too many characters for one series while also demanding that one particular character from that same series is... It's all very confusing, but that's what makes it exciting.
Yeah, it's a difficult balance to strike, and that's why I think they just went fuck it, all the characters are in there now, deal with it.
And that also, that's one last thing I'll say about the series, because not to put too much focus on it, but that actually goes to that something surprising. I never actually thought that would ever happen.
I think it's good that they held that reveal, held onto that reveal for a while, because I think it's what successfully generated hype for the franchise after the E3 presentation. So,
yeah.
Good stuff all around. Any other thoughts before we call this to a close? I'm going to take that as proof that we've discussed literally all there is about video game hype. So just as to close up, let me say that if you'd like to keep up to date with the podcast, you can follow us on our website, avocadogamescast.wordpress.com. That's right, we have a WordPress website. And we post each episode there along with a link dump that fact checks some of the stuff we say. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play Music. Just search for Avocado Gamescast. And make sure you check out, speaking of community, make sure you check out the community that spawned this podcast, the-avocado.org. Please don't type the word hyphen because that would be silly. Please type an actual hyphen.
Wait, how many people listen to this?
Thousands.
A surprising number. I thought it would be 5 or 6, but I look at the numbers of people who download it, and I've looked at subscriber numbers, and we apparently have 50 to 60 listeners. So
okay, can you go ahead and delete my confusion over that April Fool's article?
I can. If it's that means that really much to you. There, we can
cut it out. All right. Thank you all for being on the podcast, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.